You're listening to the Exploring Research Careers podcast, the podcast that talks to people about their research careers and also explores personal histories of those who support researchers. In this episode of Exploring Research Careers podcast, I speak with Dr. Maura Brophy, who graduated with her PhD in political theory in 2006. From there, she began a journey that would lead her into a new and growing profession, research management and development. Working in this sphere, Dr. Brophy realized that the skills and attributes that she possessed and developed were key to the success of working with researchers around their funding challenges and proposals. Having brought in millions of euros into research centres and departments throughout her career, we talked to her about her latest role as Dean of Graduate Studies at Athlone Institute of Technology. She also talks to us about lessons learned and how tenacity and career ownership are requirements for successful postdocs and researchers. On this episode of Exploring Research Careers, I'm joined by Dr. Maura Brophy. Maura, thank you so much for giving us your time this evening.
Julia, very happy to talk to you, Linda, of course.
Great. So we're going to get straight into the questions. I always start the podcast off with this question, which is, can you talk us through the thought process that was going on when you were embarking on your PhD?
Yeah, that's... it's complicated. I should tell you a bit about where I was at the time. I think I was never one of those people that knew what they wanted to do, right? So I think that, you know, I've given talks about my career where I used a squiggly line to describe it. At the time, I suppose I was working in professional education. I really didn't like my job, actually. You know, when I think back, it was one of those times where I should have really reflected and changed the job sooner. I had kind of done a master's. I'd taken a year out to work and done a master's after my undergrad. And then actually there's a whole other part of this as well, where I think, to be honest, I still had stuff in my head that I needed to get out. And I knew that the structures around education and research were the best way to do it in terms of working through your thoughts. And my kind of field is my home field, I suppose, is political theory, which is, it's where I did it. It's under the branch of politics, but sometimes it's under philosophy. And it's, you know, it's complex thought stuff, looking at historical thinkers as well as exploring really complex ideas. And I kind of knew I couldn't do that by myself. And I really felt like I had something stuck in my head still to get out. And I actually started a PhD in America, which I dropped out of very quickly. So my own personal stat is I've dropped out of 50% of the PhDs I signed up to.
How did that happen, the American experience?
It's a little bit hard to talk about, actually, because I really wasn't there for very long. I was one of those times in my life where I made a mistake. Like, I knew that it was really hard to have an academic career. Like, I knew it was like practically impossible. And particularly in my field, there's no industry in political theory. I mean, there kind of is, but there's not in the way that you might have in engineering or ICT. So I saw even things like, in order to get a job, you needed to have like, you need to come from outside Ireland. I knew I wanted to live in Ireland in the long term. And I kind of, you know, thought, well, what's the best thing that will give me a best shot? And American PhDs at the time, I mean, they kind of still have the structured program, but it's more like an intensive 2-year coursework, then going on to your thesis. So it's even longer, I think, than the structured PhDs that we have now. And we didn't have structured PhDs at the time. And I knew they were really well respected. And so I went through a whole year of applying. You have to do this GRE exam, and you know, and then you're trying to get scholarships to go because it's obviously very expensive. And there's the whole high achieving, I suppose most people in research careers have the high achieving difficulty with failure. And I arrived there and I immediately knew I'd done the wrong thing. Like, it just wasn't, I think I had done this, which sometimes I can be a pure head thinker, where I was like, strategically this would have been the best thing for my career, but personally it was actually the worst thing for my life, you know. Just going, and sometimes it's great. And I had before, like, I'd gone on Erasmus. I didn't really have any fear of going to a new country and starting again and all that. But it wasn't right. And I just gut knew it wasn't right when I went there. So, and I had gone after like various funding for it. I'd really fought really hard for it. And I just had to, it's one of those times when I think when you have to look at like something that really feels like failure, you know, that like, but you then kind of have to go like, this is just sometimes the right thing for you isn't the on paper right thing, you know?
you know, when you've lived a bit of a life, you can kind of say those things on reflection. But as a younger person in the moment, that would seem very difficult.
Oh, it felt awful. I remember it felt awful. I remember when I came home, I was like very, I would never be a bombastic person about success at all. Even actually probably a part of my gut knew that it wasn't the right decision when I got the funding to go. Because I remember being, instead of being really happy, being really nervous. But I kind of felt very sheepish when I came back, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And that's kind of actually why I went back to UCD. So I did my PhD, my BA and my master's in UCD. And I kind of knew like that wasn't a great thing to do for an academic career, to do your 3 degrees in one place. But I kind of, like I said, I was still driven by figuring out this stuff that was still in my head. And I knew the people there. I knew my master supervisor would be a really good supervisor. And I kind of went on a... I made the personal decision, like I self-funded my first year and my final year. I had no funding going into it. And I just knew I was doing it for personal reasons.
Just to go back to the funding bit for 1 second, that would be kind of common in your area, or no?
Not unheard of. Again, I suppose like when I did sign up to my PhD, there were only 3 of us that started that year in politics, right? So it was more the following year. But even still, historically, there hadn't been a lot of PhDs in politics. So I think the next year, there was a good few more that started, and the structured program came in the year after I did it. But
I think I've spoken to some STEM students and some people just finishing their PhD in engineering, for example, and they've been surprised that people have self-funded their PhDs in arts and humanities.
Yeah, it's not a great idea. I wouldn't recommend it. But like I said, you know, that piece of me that knew that I wanted to figure stuff out in some sort of, I had some ideas I needed to drive forward and just to get out of my head. I was like, I need this to get out of my head.
So were you thinking at that point, maybe an academic career or just the PhD?
I'm going to tell you this. I never actually really believed that I would finish my PhD. Like genuinely, when I submitted it, I thought, oh, I never thought I could actually do that. I wonder what else I can do that I didn't think I could do. I think I had made a lot of kind of very, I suppose, quote unquote, sensible life decisions up to the age of about 25. And I was always a very good student and a very good at rule following. And at that point, you know, there's some point in your life where you think, well, what works for me? And I wasn't happy. Like I knew I wasn't happy kind of working in my job. I knew I was frustrated, but I didn't know how, I didn't know a way out of it. And I knew that this was one route. And even if it wasn't an academic job, which like when I was coming to the end, there were some jobs that came up. Like I went for some jobs, but like they were really badly paid. Like, you know, at the time, I suppose like I could have gotten any work at all in an office because I'd done so much office work over the years. And probably could have gotten a salary of, I suppose, around 35,000, whatever, at that time. And the lecturing positions were pro rata salary of 25,000. And they were pro rata, meaning they employed you for 9 months of the year. And not the summer. And so somehow you would be on a really low salary and have to somehow find money to cover your 3 or 4 months of the year. Kind of, and that was, I saw that all over the world, you know. And again, so I think by the time I'd finished my PhD, I think at that point I really didn't consider an academic career. And again, another.
So what did happen?
Oh God, a load of things by accident, you know, which is probably in some level the story of my career, such as it is. I'm much more intentional now, but of course, my timing is generally dreadful. So I finished my PhD, I submitted in September 2010. We were in proper recession at that point. And like literally, I knew that kind of like the last year of my, I had got 3 years of funding, 3 individual years of funding during my PhD from my department, which was great, mainly for teaching. I did an awful lot of teaching. But I think that in September 2009, I went looking for a part-time job. And up until that point, genuinely up until the crash, I would get job offers, you know, a couple of times a month from recruitment agents because I had so much work experience in offices and I'd been an office manager and stuff like that. So I kind of knew I could get a job that would make me some money. But of course, there were no jobs at that time. There were just none. And I ended up being very lucky that I, for a number of reasons, at the time I just thought cash wise, that I got a part-time job as a receptionist in a research institute in UCD. And it was good for me because it was 9 until 1. So I did my office reception work and then I went and did my PhD for the rest of the day. Literally the rest of the day till like 11 or 12 o'clock at night for that final year. In a way, I suppose it gave me a bit of structure, but it also meant that I was working in that research institute directly with primarily people in civil engineering and environmental sciences. And obviously, like as a political theorist, these are not people that I worked with before. And in that time there, and I stayed on for a bit after I submitted, but kind of as a casual worker for a while, my discipline is a really writing discipline. So it's just drilling on writing. And what happened is I'd work with these people and I would write up what they were talking about, you know, in terms of proposals, I would help them with stuff. And I found it really easy to write. I found it crushingly difficult to write about political theory, but really easy to write about other people's research. I think part of it was the fear, you know, when it takes away your worry about being wrong when you're writing about other people's stuff. Because if it's wrong, it's fine. Like, I'm not a civil engineer. You know, like, if I mistook what you meant, that's fine. And so during that time,
should you be saying this out loud?
No, given, I know.
Given your records.
No, know what I mean? Like, I don't know. For anyone who writes, like, writing is a psychological process a lot of the time. And what I learned in the 5 years of my PhD is to get over myself, actually. That's primarily when it came to writing and to not be afraid. I found it so much easier. And if you're collaboratively writing with people as well, then the blame is shared automatically. So I suppose I found that I had this skill set. It was work that I really enjoyed. I think I was getting tired of my discipline at that point. I was getting tired of the reductive. It's not always reductive. And certainly I didn't think the work I was doing was reductive, but it could be. And it sometimes felt like that.
Because you mentioned before that you felt you had a lot of things in your head that you still wanted to get out. Do you think you maybe got them out?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I got some of them out. Here's the thing about ideas, though, and putting them on paper. The reason why it's a really good idea to put ideas on paper is because it leaves room in your head for more ideas, you know. And so I think what I learned really was a structure for processing ideas, which I don't think I had before. And I learned how to write really well because my supervisor made me. And I learned how to present, and I did a lot of teaching. And actually, I would say, you know, I'm a naturally very shy person, which no one now believes, but I am. And I remember the first few times teaching and presenting being so nervous and so stressed. And then at some point, I just had too much work to do to worry about it. And it's, I no longer worry about presenting or teaching. It just that, like, exposure to it constantly kind of push me over that. So I did get a lot out of it.
So to go back then to this kind of this skill set that you're saying, I'm kind of being introduced to this new skill set of being able to write for other people and being able to condense their ideas and their research.
Yeah, so I mean, I want to tell you, I still remember the meeting where I actually thought, oh, I could be useful in this. I was in a meeting with a project proposal, and it was between some, I think, mechanical engineers, actually, and some of our environmental science people.
So I'm going to ask a question here, which probably sounds quite judgmental, and I don't mean it like that.
Yeah. Well,
but you were working as a receptionist. So how did you even get into that meeting?
I suppose, like, to be honest, I was working in an environment where they knew I was a PhD student for a lot of the time, and I'd had lots of interesting conversations with people, and it wasn't really profoundly divided, you know, in the way that it might be in another setting. It was a research institute in the place where I was studying. But I was in the room to take notes, but in a with some really nice people who, you know, I had a good rapport with. And so I'm telling you, there was an environmental kind of science people, some business people, I think, and then the mechanical engineers. And they were looking at changing behavior in buildings based on telling people how much their energy usage costs. And they were really pushing the whole, like, well, we just tell them it's more expensive and they'll use it less. And I just kind of piped up in the meeting very sheepishly, I would say. And I said, that's just not how people behave. And they were like, what do you mean? Well, there's lots of models of behavior. Rational, logical is actually just one of the ways people make their choices. And actually, if you think about it, we actually don't really rationally make that many choices in a given day. And they were really kind of surprised by this. And they asked me a little bit about my research. My research was primarily about war. So I was like, no, this is not. But I said to them, like, something like a behavioral psychologist or something like some sort of sociologist will probably be able to give you a slant on this that would make it more effective. And they were they were very kind to me, considering I was just in the room to take notes. But after that, I think I it grew a bit more and I probably got a bit braver. But I really got the sense of like, oh, I understand a set of things that is valuable in this conversation or valuable in these explorations. And I like personally, you know, get more out of working with other people on their research than doing my own.
We might come back to that topic when we talk about your current role.
Yeah, okay.
So what happened then? So this is dawning on you that I have a set of skills here that I think I could use and really enjoy using. What happened after this role? Because this was like a temporary role at reception?
What happened was, what was I covering? I was covering a project and reception and a couple of other things. And there was more room to stay on. I think someone went on a career break and I took over some of the more kind of admin role. So just kind of, they kept me on. I was useful. They kept me around. And I kind of, when you finish, I submitted in September and was vived in February and then graduated the following September. So that is a long process. And I still didn't really know what I wanted to do, except for me, it was the trifecta of something I enjoyed, something I was good at, and something someone was willing to pay me for, which I don't think I'd found those three things before that. So I worked there for a while. We had as there always is in research, there was big changes. The smaller research institute I was in expanded to a larger research institute. So there was more work for someone working on proposals and research and with people. And I suppose, I was there for maybe 3 years in different roles, maybe. And I left that role when one of our PIs just asked me to come to his group and be a research manager for his group, which is lovely. That was in civil engineering.
So after you were vived and you'd graduated, were you still helping them with proposals and
was my job.
And then you went with this new PI.
Yeah. So I was probably like a research project officer, research admin. I had like three or four different role titles while I was there, and they were all very short term and all based on if a project came in that could pay for me or that I would work on. There were a couple of projects that needed, support that I could do that weren't necessarily full research. So,
And when you went with the PI then to be his research manager, was that primarily focused on proposals or was it kind of doing a bit of everything? Or
it was everything, actually. So the experience for me was the full project life cycle, because he had, I think, 7 million in funding that I was managing. With a big European project, a couple of other kind of smaller projects. I think there were 14, maybe 13 or 14 researchers in the group in total. I was in civil engineering, geotechnical engineering. So it was far away.
Were you a support for him getting that initial funding?
No, he had gotten some of the, I'd worked with him a bit, right? So we had, he had some major funding and some stuff that I had worked on. We got on really well. That's really, I suppose, why. And I got on with his main postdoc very well as well. And they were lovely to work with. It was one of those jobs that you get from time to time that is just a very nice experience. And just every day is very easy, and you work with nice people, and so I would have worked on proposals with them, but also day to day was more project management.
And as you moved on in that job, how long were you in that job?
I was there for maybe not quite a year and a half.
And would you have noticed your skills develop, you know, trying new things in that role or building on the previous role?
So a bit of one thing I did during that time was I did a project management course in Brussels, and it was specifically for European project management. And one thing they did with us in that course was the Belbin test, which you're probably very familiar with.
For those who aren't, do you want to give us one or two lines?
Yeah, I won't remember it properly, but it's about your kind of role in work under the kind of idea that there are different types of people in work, and we need different types of people on teams, and different people have different skills and different things they're good at, and then you have like some combination thereof, right? It's probably shaped a little bit the way I work in a team now, but for me, I came up strongest at that time as a plant or a shaper. And a plant is a very, like, unsurprisingly from the theoretical, like, nature, like, that I think about the bigger issues behind something, the principles behind it, the core of what we're doing and why we're doing it. And the shaper was the kind of influencer. You know, one of them's introverted, one of them's extroverted. It's all very, I'm very middle of the road on that. But the thing that was lowest was implementation, right? And the thing that was the thing I didn't like doing at all. And I had this, you know, again, a moment where I thought, that's my job as a project manager, it's implementation. And I kind of didn't really like the way I was working. And then when I had that realization of like, oh, I wanted to do post-award, I wanted to do full cycle project management, but actually it turns out I don't like it. You know, I like to do things. I love the proposals. I'll work on a proposal and get rid of it and then work on another proposal. And so that's really what I learned in that time. And so when I was looking for my next role, and again, that was also a very short contract, and probably I probably could have stayed a bit longer, but it would have depended on funding, you know.
How did it feel to kind of, you know, discover that about yourself, that actually, yeah, this makes sense, I'm not an implementer?
I have the, as I mentioned to you about being very sensible until about the age of 25, I have a probably ridiculous, probably because my dad's a teacher or something, like forcing myself to do things I don't enjoy, like, and kind of, you know, you're flighty.
That sounds like a masochist to me.
I know, like, anymore, Linda, don't worry about it. But I suppose, like, you know, that bit where you think, well, work should be hard, you know, like work is hard. Like you can't be enjoying work all the time. And I suppose now, well, obviously I don't enjoy work all the time. I understand the real value of work that you enjoy in the main, you know, 80, 90% of the time. And I suppose I probably was in a period where I would have been looking for another job anyway. And I knew I had good skills that were in demand. When I would work with people, because when I worked in the previous Since the Earth Institute, I had like 100 PIs or something. And so I was working with loads and loads of people all the time. And I'd have people say to me, oh my God, that's so helpful. Like I didn't know that it could be. And all I'd feel I was doing was just asking questions or asking about their research or, you know, and like I really enjoyed it. It was quite low paid. And like I said, there was constantly like short term contracts. So I never knew if I had a job in 3 months. You know, it's really, I remember things like, you know, the annual bus ticket. I could never get it because I never had a contract long enough to cover the period, which is rough, you know. So like I knew it was in demand, but I also knew at that point that I kind of needed a bit more stability. Like financially, I was in debt because of my PhD, and you know, I wasn't earning enough money to have a lot of debt, you know what I mean? So you know, I kind of knew I needed to look for another role for a couple of reasons. But I actually had, I think what I would describe in my working with the team in civil engineering was a really nice pit stop from franticness, you know, because while I had, like I said, I was in the other place for a couple of years, there was always like short-term roles. It was always, you know, are you on casual pay? Are you on, like, if, you know, and you never knew, even when your contract was up, you didn't know until like the day before it was going to, you know, so it was awful. So like, just in terms of, I mean, it was fine because I'd come out of PhD and I was used to instability, but I had this lovely kind of year and a half period with these lovely people and the work was pretty interesting. And it was just a nice emotional pit stop, because I think after a PhD, I was wrecked anyway. Like I was wrecked for a long time, was really tired and didn't want to start any new projects. And didn't want to do anything hard. Then I went to Trinity. I applied for a few jobs at the time, and not that many, but a few. And the role in Trinity had done a whole big recruitment in research program officers. And I had actually missed the main recruitment, mainly because I psychologically couldn't face applying for another job, I think probably 6 months previously or maybe 9 months previously. And then this role in computer science came up. And so I was kind of ready at that point and I applied for it. And it was funny because at that point I'd worked with so many disciplines. I was like, it's just another discipline, you know, like the same questions apply, the same probing applies, the same need for clarity and explanation applies. So I was delighted to get the job, you know. And research development, I think, you know, really overall. And I came to Trinity knowing the job, you know, which it might have been a different experience if I hadn't. And I think that's probably what's happening now to the people who work in research, are coming into those jobs now without experience. Whereas at that point, I probably had like 4 years experience working in research development pre and post award across different European programs, different national programs.
With lots of disciplines.
Yeah. And I'd say people coming into those roles now wouldn't have that experience because it was just a really new profession at the time, you know.
Mm. Okay. We're going to move away from that just for a moment. We'll probably come back to it, though, in terms of advice and lessons learned and things. Can we talk a little bit about your other experiences? Because you do have, like, when you look at your CV, for example, you've worked with researchers at risk, you've done a lot of EDI work, you've developed training and development programs, you've been involved in mentoring. Do you feel that you've had to do those things? Have you strategically sought them out? Have they just been opportunities that have come to you?
None of those things. This is a bit about, again, being a political theorist, I suppose, core values. And one of my core values is fairness. And so for me, it's a little bit of an imperative where you see unfairness to work on it, you know. And I actually don't feel like I've done a lot, you know. I've just done a few bits. I suppose the combined thing with the researchers at risk is a little bit my own background work was working on humanitarian intervention. Now, it was the theoretical approaches to humanitarian intervention, but I read enough reports on genocide to, you know, understand, at least on some level, the horror of conflict and what it does to people. And while you have to accept that you can't look after everyone, there's a cohort of people, when you're talking about scholars and researchers, that you could say, well, there are people and we should try and find ways to look after them. And I suppose that a little bit opportunistically came from a request from the European Commission on one of the programs to say, how can you support researchers at risk? And then I went with a cohort of other people and had conversations. But I suppose I took the champion role because I thought it was important and I was willing to do it. So I think that's that part. The bit around gender is more, I think, because I come from, you know, my PhD, it's political theory, but it's a human sciences PhD. So I would have done, you know, social sciences. And in social science, widely understood that sexism, inequality is real. And then you go working with, I suppose, computer science or engineering or hard sciences. And you hear these kind of things of like, women saying, well, I don't want to enter into anything to do with sexism. I just want to, you know, I'm going to be great and that's, you know, going to be enough. And you're kind of like, oh, yeah, but structures. and I suppose I think I found myself in these other fields. Like if you were in physics and you would understand that gravity is an accepted, you know, theory and understanding. And it's a little bit like that. I think inequality and sexism and the power structures is a phenomenon of well understood in the social sciences. So I think because I ended up in these spaces and to say that I went from a female dominated space to a male dominated space isn't true because political theory is actually very male dominated. But I suppose I went into in the broader disciplines that I came from were probably more female dominated, and to go into these very male spaces, you know, where people would say, oh, you know, I've never seen any gender discrimination, and I'm like, why would you? They're not discriminating against you. You know, you're not going to see it. And so I suppose I was willing to do that work. And it's back to, I suppose, my whole thing, you know, about working and wanting to do work of value and that mattering to me. And suppose I know that fairness is an important thing to me, you know. And so I you know, it's deeper than that, and it's bigger than that, because I think it's about the value of discovery and the value of research and how that enriches us all. And then if you exclude certain populations, you're excluding genius. You just are, because there's genius everywhere. And there's no racial marker of genius. There's no gender marker of genius. There's no socioeconomic marker of genius. So if you exclude people, you're automatically less rich because of it, intellectually.
And what do you think the impact of being involved in those different areas has been for you on your personally and for your career?
I think personally, it probably led to me to be quite frustrated at times. You know, that, like, there are times when, you know, when you're at a crossroads, and someone might have said to me, would you be interested in the gender inequality role? And I said, absolutely not, because I cannot spend that much of my time angry, you know. So I'd say sometimes it's personal cost. Sometimes it's really fulfilling. Like, sometimes when you help someone who otherwise would not have been helped, and to get something, that feels really good. I think, you know, anyone who's been teaching or anything like that understands that, the value of that as well. But sometimes it's quite hard. And career wise, I genuinely don't know if it's helped my career at all. Like, maybe it has, and I don't know. It's certainly, if I go to an interview job, it's something, a project that I can talk about. But when you look at hard, cold metrics that people look at a lot of the time, a lot of the work I've done is in spite of the insistence on those hard, cold metrics, like cash value funding, you know, or various successes. You know, it's in spite of that, like, rather than because of it.
I suppose I'm thinking from the perspective of, you know, getting involved and, you know, managers and bosses, like people who want to be involved in these things and do these things so that they don't have to do them, let's face it. When they would read something like that on a CV, surely people are thinking, oh, this person's interested in these areas and has accomplished these different things and would have this experience. Surely it would be a very positive thing.
I don't know. If I was interviewing, it would be a positive thing for me, but that's because I hold those values. And I think about the things we do are bigger than, you know, a metric or a KPI. But I couldn't tell you, because I
Yeah, no, it's, you know, it's an interesting, I hear what you're saying. It's interesting. I'm thinking about you having such close proximity to postdocs and researchers, and what you've noticed over the years about them in terms of their success and what makes one more successful than the other. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I mean, I think, like, owning your career is really important. I think it's really important probably for everyone. I remember at one point thinking, I was waiting for someone to come along and say, you're important and this is what you should do. And one day I had the realization that someone was me. And I think maybe there are some people that get a path shown to them. I never had anyone show me a path. Like, that sounds very crass. I mean, lots of people have helped me. Of course they have. But I never had someone ahead of me walking the route that I walked. There simply wasn't someone like that. I remember looking at something for nominations for mentors, I think. And it was like, you know, a person that has really helped you along your path. And I was like, that that hasn't happened. Like, lots of people have helped me along with that, but no one ahead of me has opened a door for me to say, this is the role you could do after I leave it or anything like that. So maybe that happens for some people. I'd say most people it doesn't happen for. Most people have to own their own career path. And I think for postdocs and for PhD students, there's a point in your career, if you want a research career, you need to step away from your supervisor because you need independence. And there's always a point. And that can be hard for some people, especially like sometimes if you have a brilliant supervisor and they really get on really well with them, it's very hard to break away, you know. That's certainly an important part, owning your own career and your own career route. And the other part of it is sort of tenacity. Sometimes we see people who are like, I am so brilliant, I'm so brilliant, and you're like, oh my god, you know, shut up. Or but there's a degree of kind of self-belief that's really needed, because academic careers are based on rejection. You get rejected from a funding proposal, you're going to get rejected from that job, you're going to get rejected from that publication, and you have to go back and do it again. So this has to be part of you that really believes what you're doing is a good idea, because you're going to get told no an awful lot. So there's, in order to be successful, you need that like thing that drives you forward. And some people I've seen who are really successful, they're like the opposite of me. Like, I'll remember every mistake I ever made. I'll wake up in the middle of the night thinking of something stupid I said when I was 6 years old. And then other people, some of these amazing researchers, they immediately forget anything that went wrong. It's gone. Like, I'm just like, if I could, if that was a pill, I'd take it, you know? And you need a bit of that. You maybe don't need to be so extreme, but you need a bit of that, because you need, I don't know if it's really resilience or it's self-belief or it's something, a core inside of you that needs your intellectual voice to be heard, but you need something, because you're going to get told no an awful lot.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes from my perspective, and I'm not a researcher, I often wonder how they stay at it.
Yeah.
You know, that they don't just get in 2 years into it and go, oh, this is just crazy. Between that kind of what they experience and the level of work that's required.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
It just seems a lot. So can we talk a little bit then about your latest role? Because you've kind of done a whole complete turnaround now, because you're now back working in academia.
It's the last thing anyone expected. Certainly me, anyway. It's the last thing I expected. Yeah, so I'm currently Dean of Graduate Studies and Research in Sloan Institute of Technology. I was appointed under a program called SALI, which is the Strategic Academic Leadership Initiative, which, because it's a program only for women, makes me think they were very happy the day they came up with that acronym. As a person who enjoys a good acronym. So this was a program of senior appointments for women across the higher education sector in Ireland.
I'm curious about when you saw the ad, were you thinking, I'm going to move, in a sense, away from what I've been doing here?
I will tell you, when I saw the ad, the reason I opened it is because in my previous job in ADAPT, as Sloan, where AIT were one of our members, and they hadn't had a head of research for ages. And I opened it because I thought, oh, they're hiring a head of research. I wonder what the job looks like. Not for me. Like, and then when I read through it, I saw that, especially because it was described as dean, I wouldn't have thought that for me. I opened it and saw that a huge proportion of the job was research development. And that a part of the job was running the graduate school. But a lot of it was about the strategic direction, which is what I had been doing. Like, I kind of moved from, I still worked on proposals, but I worked on strategic development, creating plans for capacity building and that kind of thing. That's really what I had been working on the last few years. And to refer to Belbin, making sure I worked with a finisher was always very important.
How did you know who the finisher was if you'd never met them before?
Shout out to Paolo. On Paolo's first day, we happened to do an away day, training day, and they did Belbin as part of it. And we had hired Paolo, but it was his first day, and he said he came up as a finisher, and I was like, oh, I'm so happy. Because I like to start things. I'm not, you know, wild about finishing them. But
For those of listening, Paolo is one of the research managers that Maura happens to know from a previous role.
Yeah, and he's a finisher. And so working with that for me was quite important. But yeah, sorry, what was your question?
So did you go into the interview and go, I'm not taking this job unless I'm working with a finisher?
No, I actually knew some of the people I probably would work with. They were doing restructure, so I wasn't sure. And I did what I would recommend anyone do. I did some intelligence gathering on the job. So I thought about it a lot. I thought about applying. I actually didn't apply. The deadline got extended. And I didn't. I applied when the deadline was extended. This is so many of these things that women do. I didn't think I was qualified enough for the job. And then I thought, well, women tend not to apply for jobs until unless they're perfectly qualified. And I was like, well, what am I worried about? And I said, I kind of thought, I'm worried about looking like I'm out of touch to the people that I work with currently in my job who might hear that I applied for this. So I
Can I just go back to one thing? So for students who might be listening, as you said, you did some intelligence gathering. What did that look like?
I contacted the person I knew. I knew an academic, and like it wouldn't have been involved in hiring or anything like that. And I just asked him what he thought about the role. Like, and I would ask, is someone in the role, you know, doing the role now? Is it a new role? What is it? And he just immediately said, I think you'd be great at it. Yeah, I think you should definitely apply, you know. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, and I suppose that gave me like the institutional perspective, because I knew when I suppose I had kept an eye on the IoT sector, because I knew when I didn't go straight into an academic lecturing job that the route to academic roles and senior academic roles was closed in the university sector. And as time went on, I knew that I would be a good director of research or head of research, you know, and I knew that that's kind of what my, in terms of will trajectory, at some point for the Aurora program, I had to write down where I would be in 10 years. And I said, director or assistant director of research development or research office, right? I knew that's kind of like where I wanted to go. But I also knew that I would be a good research, like strategic research leader. But I knew that those roles in the universities would go to someone who would go up through the ranks to professor or to, you know, senior lecturer to professor, and then into what would be an administrative senior management role, but only through an academic route. And so I kind of knew it was a bit different in the IoT sector. So I kind of kept an eye on it and looked out. I just watched it. I'd watched to see what.
Did you say the IoT sector?
Yeah, Institute of Technology sector. So Athlone Institute of Technologies and IoT. And they have come from a different route in the universities. And their concept, I suppose, of what is academic is broader. So while, say, the work I'd been doing for the previous 10 years of my career was considered non-academic in the university, it might be easier to consider it as research or academic in the IoT sector. So it's just... it's nothing really except, you know, this sort of broad lines that traditions and institutions draw. Like, that's all it is. And I knew I was straddling, you know, a sort of research, academic, professional service, admin sort of career at that point before that role. So, again, I thought it was a long shot. I was at the phase where I'd been in my job for nearly 5 years. And so I was thinking of a change and thinking of growth and thinking of moving. And so I was looking, I'd started to look. I didn't think it would happen this quickly. Anyway, I thought the interview would be good practice.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
And when you reflect back on that now, when I say that, what I mean is you thinking about the job, not applying, and then applying when you heard about the extension. Do you kind of give yourself a bit of a slap on the wrist going, why didn't you just apply in the first instance?
I would say I didn't see it till 2 days before the deadline was part of the meeting, okay. You know, and I didn't have enough time to do the intelligence gathering I needed until it was extended. I applied for some stretch jobs before and not gotten anywhere. So I'm a reformed self-scolder. I don't scold myself anymore. Some things you're in the right headspace for, and sometimes you're not, you know, and it would have been a shame to miss it, obviously, but if it happened, you know, that's, you don't know what's going to work out and what's not, you know.
After the interview for that, were you thinking, I could have a shot here at this?
No.
Maybe this won't be so much practice after all.
Yeah, I shouldn't admit this, but no, I was surprised to get the phone call. it's one thing, actually. Sometimes an interview can be a really enjoyable experience. You know, you have I think when you do best at interview is when you're sort of, because you're assessing the other people as much as they're assessing you. And I knew, like, I'm long enough in my career to know that fit is really important, you know, and I know that, like, it doesn't matter how brilliant the job is, if the people don't have certain values or they're not nice or, you know, I'm not going to get on well there. And so it was a really interesting interview. You know, the questions were really interesting. It's a good practice to note down the questions when you come out of an interview, because you won't remember them 2 hours later. And I, even out of the interview, I noted down some questions, but I had already forgotten half the questions I was asked, you know. So it was quite a, probing sounds more unpleasant than it was, but it was certainly exploratory and really, really interesting, you know. I liked them, you know. I liked their approach. I liked what they were doing, and when I asked questions, they were, you know, good answers. Like, so it was a really nice interview, you know. Like tough, you know, but nice, you know, in the part of me that likes to explore issues deeply, you know, it was good that way. So I suppose, like, on reflection, that was probably more representative, you know, of really what it was like. And when you're interviewed for anything, you never know what other people walk into the room before or after you. You don't know. Like, I've gone for interviews where I thought I did a great job and then not gotten it. Because someone else came in, and that doesn't mean I was bad. It just means, you know, there's someone with a better vision, or it's closer to the point, or whatever, you know. And so, I knew I did a good interview, but I also thought there was going to, I assumed there would be a second stage, and there wasn't. So I was surprised to get the phone call, and but I'm always surprised when things go right, Linda. I'm prepared for everything except success.
Hopefully this job is teaching you that's you should be changing that attitude. So give us an example, or like talk to us about, not the average day, because it does sound like different things are happening all the time, but the kind of things that you're involved in now in this role.
So it's the breath, actually, that's really changed. Like I'm probably involved in more breath of things than ever before. It's a part of the executive management team. I'm in charge of the grad school, and I think the term is like the champion for all research in AIT or something like that. We're also at a really interesting period because the organization is going through this technological university process to create a new university. So that's like, you know, it's really busy. But I would say there is like, one-to-one stuff, you know, in the sense that, like, there's a cohort of students there that I suppose I have a duty of care to. And this is, aside from the TU, obviously we're all in COVID times and the separate challenges that places and the pressures that places on students, you know, in particular. So I could have, like, a meeting with a student or a meeting about a student or something like that could happen, right up to sort of, like, looking at cohorts, like the recruitment levels, then, you know, looking at research strategy, how we might look at various other things. I suppose what I bring to them is a lot of experience in research funding and research development and research strategy. The IoT sector has traditionally not had that much research, although AIT actually is pretty good research IoT, you know, and which is why I had interacted with them before. But I suppose it's not uniform across the institute. So because I worked in so many disciplines and worked at so many different funders and so many different approaches, that's probably my biggest strength bringing there. But, you know, I care about people and I care about the students and I want them to have a good and productive experience, because I know doing a PhD is hard. And it's harder for them at the moment. So yeah, it's hard to talk about a typical day. I will tell you that at the moment, a typical day is where I am literally in a Zoom or a Teams meeting constantly. And because
I think like the rest of us.
Yeah. It's the worst of all worlds, I feel, you know, in the sense that I'm a bit of an introvert and I like time to myself, but I do also get a lot out of one-to-one meetings and some group meetings, and you don't really get that sense on a, you know, on a Zoom or a Teams or whatever.
Do you feel there's much difference? I mean, it doesn't sound like there is much difference between the last role you would have had on this. I mean, I know it's a much more senior role, but you talk about the breadth and the different things. I'm thinking about you kind of working, let's say, as far as maybe Trinity College might be concerned, you were a professional admin member of staff, whereas in this, it's kind of head of your dean of graduate studies. Yeah. I suppose I'm wondering about moving from a different sector into, and then now you're moving back, and what that's been like.
I've been in the role about, I think, 6 or 7 months now. So it's, again, I haven't really, and we haven't had, it's been breakneck since I started. So I haven't really had time to reflect, you know, which I would like to do. In, you know, when I said like that to the university sector, I knew I'd be kind of good at a sort of a senior research strategy role, but I wouldn't be available to me, at least the traditional routes. And I am good at that, you know, like that is where I'm best at, because like I said, I enjoy other people's research, you know, and I enjoy making connections and figuring out the capabilities. The roles feel very different. They're different in so many ways. I mean, part of it was, like I said, I came to Trinity knowing how to do the job. And then I was in that role in computer science for a year and a half before I went to ADAPT and was at ADAPT for nearly 5 years. So on some level, I've had great comfort in knowing what I'm doing, right, for a long time. And so this role feels really different because aspects of it I know really well, and then aspects I know much less well, and then it's an entirely new organization to me. So organization-wise, I don't know that. So it feels very different in the sense of the comfort level, you know, and the, you know, knowing where everything is, and that's gone. So it's very hard then to remove that from the functional differences in the role. Like in some ways, the stuff around research strategy and working with people and working with groups is the same. It's the same work, you know. And then other aspects, I would say, are different in the sense of the institutional level of concern and things you have to be involved in, which I obviously, and in a bigger organization like Trinity, it's been a few rungs down in a research, you know, center. That's not, you, although, you know, I would have been involved in the management of the research center, but this is just both different scale, different complexity, so that is different. And again, I don't know where everything is. I don't know who everyone is. I don't know exactly how they do things. That's probably, you know, the biggest challenge, but that's literally a challenge for every new person in a job, you know, for a while anyway, you know.
What about lessons learned?
This is very hard because I suppose very non-traditional in my approach, and I couldn't suggest that anyone replicate what I did, because that's probably not a real path for anyone. For me, look, you know, a general life thing for me is what makes you different is what makes you special. And so, like, you know, I have a different way of thinking about things to other people. I have always had that different way of thinking. And there is value in diversity of voices and people who think differently to you. So I value the people, the friends that I have, and the colleagues that I work with who think differently to me as well. Like that's really important. That's really how you grow. And we maybe sometimes are overly comfortable with people who think like us, but actually, you know, you need people who are not replicating your process. So I think the part of kind of figuring out, like, I'm never a person, I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up, right? So this is very weird to say that at this age.
I don't think you're alone there.
Yeah. And I suppose, again, like, this is the challenge of doing something like this. Like, I think it's really important to be a vulnerable person and to show the parts of you that are unsure, because that's how other people feel. And from the outside, it can look like you're really confident and you have it all together. But at the same time, you know, as you go in senior management, you have to, like, have sometimes a steely exterior, you know, and that's quite, especially for women, I think that's very hard to, it's a hard line to walk, I think. So yeah, it, be who you are, is an important thing. And I think for me, like I said, I think I struggled early in my career with stuff I didn't enjoy. And he's the you know, the stalwart at this point. I could do anything tomorrow, you know.
What would you say to people thinking about doing PhD?
Don't. it's terrible. That's probably just me being flippant, but
you're not the only person to say really that on the episodes.
Yeah, it's really hard, right? This is probably why I'm really conscious of quality in our graduate school and our, you know, like, it's really hard. It's a really hard thing to do. I think if you're doing it, you should do it purposefully. Like, I did, for all that I didn't expect an academic career, I was doing it purposefully. I needed to figure out how to approach things, or I was just going to be unhappy and frustrated, right? So do it purposefully if you're going to do it. Do not slide into it because you can't think of what to do next. That's a bad idea. Right? But know what you're getting yourself into. Get funding. It's something I would say to people. If you want any career, but especially if you want an academic career, you have to start your track record of excellence quite early on. And one of the markers of excellence is getting funding, aside from, you know, paying for food and shelter. It's also a way of saying that you are a good quality. And so I would make sure that you go and do those things as well. I feel like different disciplines have really different standards. Like in my field, like, I wrote my thesis idea. It took me ages. You know, I think I spent 2.5 years of the 5 years figuring out what my thesis was about. And then the other 2.5 years actually doing the work. That's, you know, a hard thing to do, but I think you don't know that until you're in it. If you find that it's not for you, that's fine. It's not like, sometimes it feels like academia is like a moving line of opportunities for failure. And I think particularly like high achieving people who go on to do PhDs, sometimes it doesn't suit them, you know, because sometimes people who are really good at exams don't really enjoy this thing where you have like, you know, 4 or 5 years of like, maybe you'll pass fail at the end. It's really psychologically really hard. There's no project that you would do where you wouldn't get like concrete feedback for that long a time. So it's tough. And so I'd say do it purposefully. Even if it's not necessarily because you want an academic career, but it might be because of that, or it could be because you want a research career. Certainly my PhD helped me into the job that I found, into this career path that I found. I probably wouldn't have found it without it. But I didn't know that going into my PhD, and a lot of that is serendipity. You know, at the time it didn't feel like that. At the time it felt like I'd failed to have an academic career. So it didn't feel good, you know. I had a friend who dropped out after 3 years, and he would say to me, but you completed and I didn't complete. So he, you know, and I was like, I don't think people get to the end and they're like, yay, I'm amazing. They feel like, oh God, here I am, still standing, you know. So that's it. I'm going to say do it purposely. And I would say the other really important things around it are actually your supports in general. So your life needs to be kind of supported. It's you're going to go through something that's very difficult, so you need like good friends and, you know, good life outside of your PhD. And there'll be times where a PhD will take over almost. You'll end up like dropping your hobbies and not seeing your friends for a couple of months or something like that. But you definitely need to have those parts of your life kind of, I think, supported and encouraged and built up, because you're going to do something really hard.
Mm. And would you have different advice for postdocs?
Postdocs, I would say, postdocs are, you have to drive forward now at this point. If you're just after doing your PhD and you're in your first postdoc, you're probably very tired. And it's the last thing you want to hear. But again, being purposeful about your career, figuring out a career plan, even if it's just like a sort of a skills plan, quite important, because I think some postdocs can drift for a little bit at the start. And I think you have, like, you're actually still on a time clock. Like, maybe life is a time clock, I don't know. But you can't really rest on your laurels, especially if you really do want an academic career. You might get to take a few weeks off, but you'll then have to be driving forward. And again, like, being purposeful, being tenacious, like getting over those rejections, those are the things that will help you push your career, you know.
Maura, it's been absolutely lovely speaking with you like this. It's been so interesting. I don't know whether you want to add anything else at the end, but...
I don't know. listen, don't forget, actually, that research is amazing. Like, that it is, if you're a researcher, you're at the edge of knowledge. Like, you're in discovery, and you're curious, and you're creative, because you're imagining a world that doesn't exist. And I think sometimes we lose that, because obviously it's really hard. And I think that, again, if you can connect to your purpose, at some point you felt that curiosity and that drive, and you probably feel that every so often. But when you're kind of really despairing or something's going wrong, to remember that's where you are. The reason why it's hard is because you're an explorer, and exploration is hard, you know. But it can be really, really worthwhile, you know. And I think... researchers are brave.
I think that's the perfect way to end, and I totally agree. I think they're amazing individuals. I really do. Yeah. Maura, thanks so much for your time and for all of your conversation tonight.
Thanks, Linda.
We've come to the end of this episode of our podcast, Exploring Research Careers. If you like the podcast, maybe you want to tell your friends and colleagues, or anyone who you think might get benefit from listening to the conversations. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at @Eeyore_careers, where you can find new episodes as they're released. In the meantime, thanks for listening and take care.